Call the Energy Finance and Policy Division to order. First order of business would be the approval of the minutes from Wednesday, March 3rd, 2010. Chair would entertain a motion to that effect. Representative Brainerd moves approval of the minutes. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor of their adoption, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. First bill on the agenda for today. And before we begin, members, I need to point out that following us in the occupancy of this room is Representative Dill's subdivision from Environment and Natural Resources. They're considering land bills today and have a number of bills on the agenda and have implored us to please finish on time and let them occupy the room, and we will do everything we can to try to honor that request. And on Wednesday, we will be taking up the Division Finance Bill. Members will find a spreadsheet in their packets. That is the proposal that we intend to bring forth on Wednesday, so please avail yourselves of the opportunity to look that over. And with that, Representative Kelly, House File 3254. Representative Gunther.
I move House File 3254 and recommend it pass and move to the floor.
Move into the chair.
Thank you, Representative Gunther. That motion is before us. Representative Kelly, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe there's also an amendment to the bill.
There is. I think members will find that amendment in their packets. Representative Gunther.
Mr. Chairman, I move the A1 amendment to House File 3254.
Thank you, Representative Gunther. That motion is before us. Discussion to the amendment. And members, I would ask that you take a look at this amendment. It's only one line, but I think it's an amendment of some substance, and perhaps we should have some discussion before it's adopted. If there is any. Representative Overmuir.
Mr. Chair, if we could just tell me what the two acronyms refer to there, that would be helpful to me.
The LWECS stands for Large Wind Energy Conversion System, and the WECS would just be any wind energy conversion system of any size. Representative Kelly, is that correct?
Yes. Yes, Mr. Chair, it is.
Representative Falk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Kelly, could you explain the need or the reason behind the change from encompassing just large wind energy conversion systems to all wind energy conversion systems with respect to your bill?
Absolutely, Mr. Chair. Representative Falk, the amendment would allow for an all-encompassing language. That will help us as we move to the bill, because the bill clarifies language in the permitting process. So in order for it to work across the board, that's why we decided to go with all wind energy conversion systems to make it more efficient.
Representative Falk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm a little nervous about this language because, I mean, this encompasses everything down to the smallest of small turbines. If you want to put up something on a residential facility, having to go through an entire public utilities commission or following those rules for even the smallest, like the Jacobs 20 kW machines, or even the smaller Burgee, like 6 kilowatt machines that are primarily for home or residential or farm use, it seems like it's almost becoming onerous. I know in 216F that there are exemptions put in place for small wind energy conversion systems that they wouldn't have to comply with the guidelines of permitting other energy facilities, and that current cap is at 5 megawatts, and I was actually working on a bill to go and extend that to allow counties that would so wish to do permitting of up to 25 megawatts with certain restrictions be allowed. So,
Representative Falk, I think you mean kilowatts. Or,
5 megawatts is what the
limit. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're right.
But I guess that this just seems very, what this change is very restrictive when it comes to a local person trying to put up one of these small turbines or even some of the smaller projects, and you're creating an onerous burden on them having to go through all these additional rules that are designed for the more than 25 megawatt projects.
Representative Kelly.
Mr. Chair and Representative Falk, thank you for the question. And the clarification there is this would only apply, it's my understanding, this would only apply to those systems where the PUC enters into the permitting process, whereas, you know, they would not for those lesser systems.
Representative Falk.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Kelly. But I do believe in changing the definition to WECS, you're encompassing all wind energy conversion systems. There's not being a distinction between small or large, but it would become all of them. So all of the smalls would then have to go in, even down to the most minute of all systems, have to fall under the PUC rules.
Mr. Chair and
Representative Kelly.
Mr. Chair and Representative Falk, though, I believe that the exemption of 216, though, as you indicated, actually would apply to this legislation as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Perhaps I should pass the statute book over to Mr. Eliff, and he can offer the clarity which we are looking for.
I was just going to invite Mr. Eliff to do that. Mr. Eliff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking at 216F.02 paragraph C, which says nothing in this chapter shall preclude a local governmental unit from establishing requirements for the siting and conversion of a small wind energy conversion system. So current statutes already allow for essentially that the change that this change we're talking about in this bill, it seems to me.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Kelly.
Could I have Mr. Glahn help us out here on wading through this language?
Be he so willing.
Mr. Chair.
Director Glahn, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Bill Glahn, Deputy Commissioner of Commerce, Director of the Office of Energy Security. To Representative Falk's question, that I appreciate Representative Kelly doing his best to keep us out of this, but this was an amendment that we had suggested to the author. And the reason why we suggested it was at least our understanding that the counties in adopting official controls adopt official controls for the equipment, the wind energy conversion systems. And what we wanted to do was make that clear in dropping the L from LWEX, not trying to speak to any who has jurisdiction over what, but just trying to accurately reflect what it is the county, what the county regulates when they're regulating these things. And that's why we asked that in those two instances the L be dropped, because we think the counties look at equipment, and it's up to whatever the controlling authority is to, are these small systems or large systems or medium systems, depending on how many of them are, how many of these pieces of equipment get aggregated together into a project. So we weren't trying to change the thrust of who is going to regulate what, but just try to add a little bit of clarity to what it is the counties are actually setting standards for. We understood it to be equipment and not so much the projects themselves.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Director Glahn, I believe that's taken care of with size determination. Whenever you're going to be doing a project, you'd have to get that size determination letter from the, would it be the, either the PUC or your office? I'm trying to read here quickly while speaking, but I think that that's already taken care of in 216F.011.
Director Glahn.
Mr. Chair, Representative Falk, just trying to help here clarify.
Further discussion to the amendment. Seeing none, all those in favor of its adoption, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
Motion prevails, the amendment is adopted. Representative Kelly, to your bill as amended, what are you trying to do here?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. First and foremost, this is not an affirmation or opposition of any wind as alternative energy. This is really more about just some local control here. As with most of these projects, I guess plenty of discussion happens, and we happen to have one proposed in our district. So that's when the questions started coming to our office. It was a matter of, well, what can the counties do? What can't they do in this permitting process? And my constituents wanted to know where they could go to be heard. So in that regard, both Representative Drazkowski and myself attended the PUC hearing on this project, and our intent there was to ask for some clarification in the process itself. And I'd like to say thank you again to Director Glahn and his staff, because the PUC really did help us out with this language in trying to come up with some clarification, so that really what it allowed to speak to is that the fact that Minnesota certainly is a diverse area, both in topography and population density. So in that respect, I believe that we can't really take a cookie-cutter approach across the state in all of these projects. And I think it's a good practice to allow the local county boards and the local governments to listen to their people as a more efficient matter in the process. Because if there is opposition, if there is something coming out, we're going to hear that first there. So in essence, I believe we'll actually streamline the process instead of having to wait to go to a PUC hearing and intervene there. We can answer a lot of these questions, whether it's an opposition or, again, affirmation of the project, earlier on. So what we do not want to do, we do not want to circumvent the PUC process. Absolutely not. We believe that's where the process has to take place, and they're the experts. But what we'd like to do is to allow the local authorities and individuals to have some input there. So with the help of the PUC and with the Association of Minnesota Counties on board, what we feel is that we've got, we're confident we've created legislation to address both those issues.
Representative Kalin, do you have a question?
Just a thoughtful look on my face, Mr. Chair.
Very well. Any discussion to the bill? Representative Kelly, just in plain English, my reading of the bill suggests that what the bill, if passed, would do is make siting of any wind project, and particularly the larger wind projects, more difficult. Would you agree with that assessment?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure if it would be more difficult, but it certainly opens up the discussion to say, from a county board standpoint, for example, to say if we're not in agreement with the permit requirements as they're set, the board could step in and request different ones, but not to say that that's the intent of it, but just to say that that's a possibility. And I guess from that standpoint, could they say that the setbacks or the requirements on any other parts of the issue could be more generous, maybe. I guess that's a possibility as well, but then the PUC would imagine, step in at that point. And Mr. Chair, also have a commissioner from the County of Goodyear who would also like to speak to this.
Representative Kelly, we have a number of people on the list wishing to testify, and if there are no further questions at this time, we would call on Ted Seifert, Goodhue County Commissioner, to come down. We also have on the list members Adam Sokolowski, Blake Nixon, and Bill Grant.
Mr. Chair, Representative
welcome
of the committee. My name is Ted Seifert. I've lived in Goodhue County for 35 years, and for the last 7 years I've been a Goodhue County Commissioner. I'd like to thank you for this opportunity to give some testimony. I support House File 3254 and the amendment. The I understand the legislature's need to be on board for a national energy policy, and I'm for that. The devil is in the details. When we start citing windmills in sparsely populated areas, that's fine. As we get into more densely populated areas, they begin to cause some problems. And rather than have a one-shoe-fits-all approach to this, I think it would be very good for local authority to be able to weigh in and modify the setting of windmills, the siting of them. I don't oppose the wind projects, but I want to leave our constituents both equally unhappy, those who oppose it and those who say they want it. They need to be able to use their land in a way that will maximize their profits. And on the other side of the fence, we have some people who said, we'd like to enjoy our land and we don't want a windmill just right on the other side of that property line. And that's what the local authority can do, is moderate that debate.
Questions for Commissioner Seifert? Commissioner, one of the changes in the bill is a language change, deleting standards and inserting official controls. What's your understanding of the significance of that change?
Mr. Chairman, we already have ordinances for the siting of the smaller wind projects. And somebody who wanted to have a special use to put up a windmill would have to come to the county as it is. If the PUC wanted to site those small projects, that would be fine. If, on the other hand, they would let the county staff do that, that would work well. Small windmills don't create quite the problem that these very large windmills do. And we have the staff that could site that. While we would be at a disadvantage if we were to have staff that would site the very large seabed projects, that would be a very large expense for a county like Goodhue.
There are further questions for this witness? Seeing none, thank you, sir. I'm going to call on Bill Grant next. I think he has a conflict of meeting times. Mr. Grant, welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Bill Grant for the Isaac Walton League, and I'll be very brief. I wanted to let you know that I was the chair of the first statewide task force that developed the state siting guidelines back in the mid-1990s, and I think there's ample evidence that the guidelines that we put in place then and have tweaked several times since then have worked very well. In fact, we've cited now something on the order of 1,800 megawatts of wind statewide. I'm concerned about any change to this statute that would make it more difficult to site wind energy projects. I think we've seen some evidence just in the last year or so that Minnesota's position has slipped nationally in terms of the progress that we're making in siting and building new wind projects. We've fallen behind Iowa, of all things, which I take as a real affront to Minnesota. And I'm concerned that this provision will have the same effect. The regulatory process that we have in place now is predictable. It's very thorough in its movements, and it doesn't pick winners and losers in these processes. I'm concerned that moving to a siting projects by individual counties would make siting more difficult. To get to the goals that we put in place for ourselves through the renewable energy statute. The renewable energy standard. That's going to be a difficult standard to meet, and one that putting more roadblocks in place of is not good policy. So,
any questions for Mr. Grant? Seeing none, thank you, Mr.
Thank
Grant.
You, Mr. Chairman.
Next on the list, we have Adam Sikorski. Mr. Sapolsky, welcome to the committee. Sorry we didn't get a chance to hear from you the other day. Thank you for your patience.
Thank you, Chairman Hilty. Thank you, committee members. My name is Adam Sokolsky. I'm a developer, wind project developer with Iberdrola Renewables. I develop projects in Minnesota, Wisconsin, Iowa, North and South Dakota. Our company owns about 400 megawatts of wind here in Minnesota, and we're going to be building another 150 megawatts more here this summer, about 62 more turbines. I'm here to express some concerns about House File 3254. Three primary reasons. First of all, impacts on the renewable energy standard. Minnesota's got one of the best state policies that encourage new renewable energy in the country. It very well may be the best renewable energy standard in the country. As you've seen on a daily basis, it has driven and will continue to drive a lot of economic development, investment, and jobs in clean energy, and significant tax revenues for the state of Minnesota as a result. We're concerned with House File 3254's language that would allow for further delay or reduction of renewable energy standard milestones that have been put into place. We think it does that by, first of all, creating a new off-ramp of sorts on the first page that allows for that delay and that reduction. And in addition, as I'm going to talk about in a moment, by encouraging the broad, potentially permanent prohibitions to wind energy development across entire counties, serves as a secondary impact or secondary way that we think that renewable energy standard may be impacted negatively, as well as the general development in culture here in Minnesota. Secondly, we believe House File 3254 may balkanize the process of siting wind projects in Minnesota. It'll make wind development more difficult, not just in Goodhue County where projects might be controversial, but potentially in other places across the state where wind projects might be viewed with more open arms. Again, the bill appears to open broad, potentially permanent prohibitions against development across agricultural lands, exactly the locations where we want to develop wind projects. Under 3254, if a county has enacted a broad prohibition against wind development, the PUC must enforce that public or that prohibition. That's going to stifle development. It's going to take away opportunities to develop new wind farms in good locations. It's also going to take away people's rights and their ability to develop and use their lands as they see fit, subject to statewide or local regulation. We're also concerned that House File 3254 singles out the wind energy industry in a way that no other energy industry is singled out in the state. When a project goes through the Utility Commission process, be it a wind project, be it a transmission line project, a pipeline project, a nuclear power plant project, it's the state standards that apply and the state standards that have the state has jurisdiction for setbacks. In this case, however, we have the counties superseding the state only when the county is more restrictive. And that brings up a lot of concerns for those of us in the wind industry. We don't want to be singled out. We don't want to be treated any different than any large energy facility. And this, we believe, will treat us much, much differently. I know, having both worked over at the Office of Energy Security as well as having projects put through the state siting process, I know that the Utilities Commission considers local zoning and county input at every time they look at a site permit for a wind energy facility. There's numerous opportunities for the county to be involved, for the county and its residents to participate in the siting process, and the commission opens its arms to those public involvement opportunities and those comments. So I thank you for the time today to testify briefly on this on House File 3254. And I hope you can vote it down. Thank you.
Questions for this witness? Seeing none. Mr. Sapolsky, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, actually.
Representative Beard.
As I'm thinking about Mr. Sokolsky's testimony, you do business in both Iowa and Minnesota. The gentleman from Isaac Walton a few moments ago talked about Iowa pulling away from us. a little bit. I'm curious as to your observations, having worked in both.
Okay.
Thank you. Having worked in both states, just a quick view of why you think that is, permitting, speak about siting permitting and so on. And do they have county input like this in the Iowa siting process and authority? Can you talk to us a little bit about what our neighbors are doing?
Mr. Sapolsky.
Chairman Hilty, Representative Beard. Minnesota and Iowa are very different animals when it comes to siting wind projects. Iowa is entirely by county process. It's, I don't want to say quite open season, but it's very permissive. Okay. When we go down into Iowa, we get very much are welcomed with open arms. There is no state standards. There is no noise standard in Iowa. Frankly, when you compare it to Minnesota, it looks like Minnesota is at a big competitive disadvantage with the state program and the level of restrictions in the siting. The good thing about Minnesota's state program is that a developer knows exactly what he or she needs to do to comply with the rules, knows what the standards are. They're tough. Believe me, they're tough. They require big setbacks from non-participating landowners in a way that no other state does. But they're fair. The commission has a long public process you must go through, and they rule in the end based on facts and a record, not on politics. You know what you need to do. You know the stick you're going to be measured by, and there's a lot of certainty and predictability and understanding based on that. So they're different animals. I don't think the siting process in Minnesota is was restricting development too much here in the state. Iowa's got a good transmission system. They've got fantastic winds and a real need for economic development. So some of those negatives, maybe with some of the siting issues in Iowa, are made up in other ways. I don't ultimately know what the final solution is, final answer is, why Iowa jumped so much further ahead over the last few years. But that's probably a growth rate that's not sustainable long term.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Beard.
The comments regarding the siting process are what I was going to, and honestly, it was a question I did not know the answer to, which is a very dangerous question to ask, I know. But I think it's been helpful for the committee to hear a little bit about somebody who actually does business in Iowa with how we stack up. So just to be clear, you're saying Iowa's got a county-by-county basis, a little more wide-open system. They don't have to appear in front of a PUC that has statewide authority, much like we have here. Is that what I heard you say?
That's true, and I'm not sure if that's an entirely a good thing or a bad thing.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. No further questions. Last person asked to testify is Blake Nixon. Nixon, welcome to the committee and members. I hope that we will be able to conclude our discussion of this bill and bring it to a vote in the next few minutes, because we do have two more bills on the agenda, and as I mentioned initially, we do have to be out of this room today. Mr. Nixon.
Mr. Chairman, representatives, thank you very much for your time. I will be brief given the agenda and the fact that Mr. Sokolsky is well represented the wind industry in general. I just wanted to say a few.
Mr. Nixon, we need you to identify yourself.
My name is Blake Nixon. I'm the president of Geronimo Wind Energy. We're a Minneapolis-based wind developer. We've built two projects here in Minnesota so far, developing another dozen. Sorry about that. My few comments are really quick and to the point. The first one is that our process works. It works extraordinarily well. The process I'm referring to is the state-based process administered by the PUC. And the numbers have been thrown around, but anecdotally I heard a couple of months ago from the person who hears the complaints about operating wind farms that of the 1,800 megawatts of wind farms in this state, in the past 10-plus years he's received three complaints. Two of which from a single turbine that was having mechanical failures and creating noise that was subsequently fixed. I think that's a heck of a batting average. Secondly, moving more control to the local level, simply will increase the risk profile of development in this state. It will decrease the amount of development in this state, and it will decrease the amount of economic development in this state, particularly in rural America, which all of us are very keen on supporting economically. My final point is that Minnesota has been looked to as a leader in this regard, and we just need to look to our other neighboring state of Wisconsin, who just this past year had its governor sign into law, and now its PUC is putting into practice state-based standards because, very succinctly, the county-based siting standards were, my words, not theirs, a failure, and created a very large issue in moving the wind development industry in Wisconsin forward. Thank you for my time.
Questions for Mr. Nixon? Seeing none, thank you. Further discussion to the bill? Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate the opportunity to continue a discussion we had on Representative Falk's bill earlier last week. I think Mr. Sikalski's point is well taken. You know, I hate to do this to Representative Kelly because it's the second year in a row that we've had a local bill that has been in a policy area that I care deeply about. But I think that the best move in this bill would be to follow the lead of our policy in every other area, and that is to not just have it apply to wind energy conversion systems, but to large energy facilities across the board, and go ahead and let our counties have the say. It's a big issue in my district right now, and I think that I know Mr. Eliff and I have discussed an amendment. I'm actually not going to offer it because of our time, but I do think that it raises a very important point that a natural gas plant or a coal plant or a nuclear plant, if the certificate of need moratorium were amended, wouldn't have to go through this process. And yet, if you're going to put up a small, a few wind turbines at a tenth or a hundredth of that size, the county would have to. And I just think that it's there are better ways that we can make sure that we're aligning our county ordinances with our statewide energy policy. We need to have that discussion. I respectfully would ask members to not support Representative Kelly's bill, but to continue talking about how we can make sure that there's significant local impact or discussions of local impact on all large energy facilities or all energy facilities in general. I don't think there's an adequate process for that yet. I don't think that this is the solution to doing that, though.
Further discussion to the bill? Representative Kelly.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you. It occurred to me as I was listening to some of the opposition that actually some of the arguments I was thinking, well, that is an argument for this legislation. It would suggest we're losing to Iowa. Well, I think it might be obvious. We have a national energy policy, and I think alternative energy is right at the top of that list. And as we look at our state, and we look at the state of Iowa, I don't know if anybody's driven through Iowa, it's generally different. And isn't it, it's kind of obvious to me that maybe the reason they're pulling ahead is because that's where the wind energy is easily sited. And just as a note, I have a client from Moorhead who came down to our area in Red Wing, and the first thing she said is she said she really enjoyed coming down here because she liked to see the mountains down in Red Wing. Well, I think that attests to the fact that we have vast differences in terrain across this state. We have developed wind in fantastic areas, but now we're also looking at population density. It might be just possible that we're coming down to areas where we need that local input. We need that input to the PUC. So that's what we're asking you today, is to allow individuals to talk with their local governing entities and for those entities to give their input to the PUC, not to circumvent the PUC process, but allow for that input from our local governments. So I guess I would ask you to support this legislation. I appreciate your time, Chair.
Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a quick correction for Representative Kelly. I'm hoping that you're speaking prophetically. We actually don't have a national energy policy that that has a renewable energy standard or similar pieces that we have here in Minnesota. My hope is that we will soon. I think that Congress and the President are deeply engaged on this issue. It's, as you know, led by Lindsey Graham, Senator McCain's presidential campaign chair nationally. So my hope is that you're right, but not yet.
That's followed.
Seeing no further discussion, Representative Gunther renews his motion that House File 3254, as amended, be recommended to pass and placed on the General Register. All those in favor of that motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
The motion fails.
Division.
Division has been called for. All those in favor of the motion, please signify by raising their hand. Thank you. All those opposed? On a vote of 6 in favor, 11 opposed, the motion does not prevail.
Mr. Chair, thank you for your time.
Representative Beard, can we do your bill in about 2 minutes?
Yes, we can.
Or one?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Beard.
Members, I'd like to move House File 3259, recommended pass, and be placed on the consent calendar, if I can be so bold. Can you do that for me?
We'll wait until you renew your motion in order to see what you care to do in that regard. Representative Beard.
Certainly. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. This bill was brought to me by our friend Ron Elwood from Legal Services. Legal Aid Society, excuse me, who will speak here in just a moment. This bill concerns disconnection notices for tenants in a building where a landlord may have fallen in arrears on his utility payments, whether it's water, gas, electric, or such. It expands a little bit on the posting notices and allows tenants to actually step forward and make sure that their services are not disconnected if they wish to voluntarily enter into an agreement with the utility. Instead of having the building shut off, the tenants can protect their building in common or by themselves, apparently. This will help clarify those issues so that they'll be more clearly and visibly informed when there is a threat of utility disconnection. Mr. Chairman, I'd appreciate if we could have Mr. Ron Elwood speak a little more clearly to it and stand for questions if you wish.
Mr. Elwood, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Ron Elwood, Legal Aid. A couple years ago when we did a lot of work around the foreclosure crisis and tenants in foreclosure, we beefed up the protections for tenants to keep their service on when the property owner falls behind on gas, electric, or water bills. And what this bill does is simply make it clarify that what the utilities already do, which is to make sure that the tenants actually get notified when their gas, electric, and water is going to be shut off by having a posting. The other thing that this does, and this came to us from the League of Cities, is help all the utilities a little bit, because current law says the posting has to be in the building. And we've heard from some of the utilities that oftentimes that creates a problem because, A, they can't get in the building, they have the access problems, or potentially they don't have a legal right to get in there. So it's a little kind of mushy. So this allows them to post in or on the building in a conspicuous place. All the utilities, I've spoken to each and every one of them, including the munis and the co-ops, and I'd like to thank them for their cooperation. They all think it's a good idea. Nobody's opposed, so we appreciate your support.
Questions on the bill? Representative Beard.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to renew that motion I made a little while ago, if I may. I will add that I did talk to the Multi-Tenant Housing Association, and they're enthusiastically in support of the clarifying language as well.
Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify for or against the bill? Seeing none. All those in favor of the Beard motion to pass House File 3259 and place it on the consent calendar, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed?
Thank you.
Motion prevails. Representative Clark, House File 1633.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do have an amendment to House File 1633. If somebody will move both the bill and the amendment, I'd sure appreciate it.
Representative Clark, first of all, the chair will move that House File 1633 be recommended to pass and placed on the general register. And then I believe you would wish to offer the DE1 amendment?
I believe it's DE2.
DE2 amendment. Picked up the wrong one, just a moment here. All right. DE2 amendment, which I believe members have in their packets, and since this is a delete all amendment, that would put the bill into condition in which Representative Clark wishes to have it considered. The chair will move the DE2 amendment. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor of its adoption, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? No. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Clark, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Clark, before you begin, let me point out that we have approximately a half hour or a little bit more before we have to be out of this room. And we have a number of people who have asked to testify. Hopefully they can keep their comments brief. It is my intention to have a vote on this bill at approximately 4:25, and I hope everyone will keep that in mind. Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, I have asked the witnesses to try to keep their comments brief, a couple minutes, maybe 3 minutes at the most. This is a bill that has brought a lot of attention to the Phillips neighborhood in South Minneapolis, and I'm bringing to you today a bill that will require a certificate of need, a change in the existing law for certificate of needs, so it'll cover this project. And this is a high voltage transmission line that's about a mile and a half long. The current law says that there's no certificate of need required for these high voltage transmission lines unless they're more than 10 miles. So we are raising the issue that because this is a densely populated inner city community, majority people of color community, that we think the conditions of dense population and the kinds of burdens this brings to that neighborhood should allow us to have the certificate of need process go forward on this proposed high voltage transmission siting. So I'm going to ask a few people to speak to this. One of the things I've done is what the chairman requested, which is we've crafted this language so that it only applies to this project in this neighborhood and it applies to none other. And we're keeping it to that at this point. I will say when we're done here, I was approached about an hour and a half ago by Excel with some ideas about some ways we could work together for something in the future. And I think, you know, after this process is done today, we intend to do that. But for today, we're going to go forward with what we have proposed. And I would like to ask for a few witnesses to make some comments, Mr. Chairman. First, I'd like to ask Paula McAbee.
Ms. McAbee, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paula McAbee, and I represent the Midtown Greenway Coalition in connection with the Hiawatha Project proceeding, which is a proceeding to put a 115 kV power line through a densely populated area of South Minneapolis. We've been asked to supply testimony, and I will try and be brief. The first concern is that many community members feel pretty strongly that the Hiawatha 115 kV project is not needed, and that if load management and conservation and distributed generation had been implemented, they could meet what are actually very legitimate needs for reliability, increased reliability in the South Minneapolis area. And so that's the first concern, is could conservation, load management, distributed generation meet the need? The second issue, and I think that Representative Clark has distributed or is distributing a map. The second concern of the community is that this project is not really just 1 mile of 115 kV. There were transmission planning documents filed in 2007 that, and I didn't prepare this map, but that this map shows that the intention, at least in the transmission planning documents, is for a much longer project that starts at 494 and ends up at 280, and that this is just one segment. In the documents for the Hiawatha project itself, Xcel Energy said that they needed space right here on Hiawatha. It'd be a substation. In their own application, they said they need space to expand that substation to include a 345 kV line that would go up Hiawatha Avenue. So even in the documents for this project, they're suggesting there'd be an expansion. And a few weeks ago, Xcel said that there's no, quote, current plans to construct a 345 kV line in the South Minneapolis area, but with, quote, additional load growth, it may be necessary to introduce a larger 345 kV source to relieve the 115 kV system. And without a certificate of need, there's no way for people in the community to figure out how big is this project, how many people is it going to impact, how many volts of current is it going to carry, and what are the risks. And finally, this came in the direct testimony that was filed last week by some representatives of Little Earth. There's a study being done now by the University of Minnesota that suggests that some of the problems in terms of brownouts and blackouts are due to the aging distribution system. So that even if we build, if Xcel builds at our cost this project, there may still be reliability problems. So all three of these areas, which is the project needed, is it going to expand, and how big? And is the project, if it's built, actually going to solve the reliability problems? They're not part of a routing procedure. So if the routing procedure goes through without Representative Clark's bill, we'll never get the answers to those questions. And I think it's really important. This is an unusual area. It is very unusual for a utility to be putting a 115 kV line in a densely populated urban area. We asked Xcel when was the last time you put a 115 kV line overhead in this densely populated area, and it goes back to the 1950s in Cedar West and Frogtown and Marcy Homes. It's not a thing that's customarily done. There are homes and businesses within the fall zone of these 115-foot towers. There are developers who said they plan to invest in South Minneapolis and bring up the property values and bring in new jobs, and that the presence of the power line, particularly if it's overhead, would discourage them. There's also FHA rules having to do with affordable housing financing, that if there is a high voltage power line overhead, it's one of the factors that they use that to deny funding, so that affordable housing plans would be impacted. So this project has a lot of impacts, and before it goes forward, it is very important to the community that they know whether it's really needed, they know it will solve the local problems, and that any impacts will be mitigated. So having a certificate of need provides an opportunity to encourage distributed generation, smart grids, and conservation, and to make sure that if a community is going to have a power line, whether overhead or underground, that it's been thoroughly evaluated to determine that that's needed. Be happy to answer any questions.
I think if we could have the testimony first, Mr. Chairman, and then call people back for questions. I want to try to honor your recommendation. Thank you. Councilmember Robert Lilligren. And after that, Tim Springer.
Representative Clark.
Angelina.
Yes. At some point, we'll... I don't know who we have at the...
This is Councilmember Robert Lilligren.
At some point before we run out of time, I want to get Director Guan to the table.
Mm-hmm. That's fine.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, I'm Robert Lilligren. I'm the Vice President of the Minneapolis City Council. I also represent the 6th Ward, which is just south of downtown and completely within Senate District 61, except for one precinct. My district is almost identical to Representative Karen Clark. So thank you for this opportunity to testify today in support of House File 1633, which the City of Minneapolis has taken a position in support of I have lived almost 30 years in the southwest corner of the Phillips area. I live within the proposed project area myself. It's a part of the city that has borne a lot of negative impacts from investment, whether it's from soils that have been poisoned with lead or whether it's the air pollution. The borders of Phillips area are 35W on the west, 94 on the north, and Hiawatha on the east, and so there's a lot of contamination from vehicles as well. And so this is a population and area that has been significantly negatively impacted over time. And it's also the sixth ward. All of our wards in the city of Minneapolis are about 33,000 people, and the sixth ward is the smallest by area, so it is the most densely populated. So a bill like House File 1633 really relates to the part of the city that I live in and the part that I represent. And I am editing my comments as we go in consideration for your time here. And I would just like to say a couple things. One, in the nature of the area, it's a part of the city that has suffered significantly from the blight during the last half, during the last century, and it is one that has turned around considerably. I represent neighborhoods that are no longer considered impacted neighborhoods because of the development and the investment that's been going on in the area at the grassroots level from residents and homeowners, small business owners, and large operations like Wells Fargo Home Mortgage and the Alina Medical Campus as well. One of my concerns as a municipal representative is that the presence of a high voltage facility in this area would have a chilling effect on further investment in the area and would mean that we'd be losing some of the ground that we have gained. The demographics of this area as well, I represent the area, it's about 70% people of color, something like 40% people of in poverty. These are populations that have been recognized as being negatively impacted over history and for that reason have been given consideration within law to be protected from facilities, and I think this bill, which would address the density, high-density areas, would be very welcome in the communities I represent. And also, it would give the city of Minneapolis the opportunity to engage in a more meaningful way with the applicant for a high-voltage facility like this through the needs assessment, where we could work to explore the introduction of alternatives, the introduction of on-site generation, on-site storage, of conservation as well. And my concern is absent this law, no facility in Minneapolis is going to be 10 miles long, and absent this law, which is designed to protect the people that live under or near this facility, the city of Minneapolis is never going to have the opportunity to engage with the utilities in this way. So I would urge the passage of House File 1633. Thank you.
Thank you, Councilor.
Good afternoon, Committee Chair and members. My name is Tim Springer. Thank you for taking this issue up today. I am Executive Director for a nonprofit organization called the Midtown Greenway Coalition. Our mission is to empower communities to develop, improve, protect, and enjoy the Midtown Greenway as a green urban pathway to improve people's lives. Xcel is proposing two high-voltage transmission lines for roughly a 1.25-mile distance east to west, parallel to, along or parallel to the Midtown Greenway in Minneapolis. Because of the relatively short distance of the line, a certificate of need is not required, which means that the PUC cannot deny the project based on need. Which would, if a certificate were required, of course, allow us to examine whether other methods could be used to provide the power that's needed in this area. The PUC currently can only rule on where the wires go. The Midtown Greenway is the busiest bikeway in the state of Minnesota. It has a morning rush hour for bicycles and an afternoon rush hour for bicycles. It's a big success story. It runs 5.5 miles east to west across Minneapolis, connecting the chain of lakes with the Mississippi River, and it runs parallel to Lake Street as it passes crosses the city. The communities served include a wide range of income levels and demographics, and along the middle segment in the greater Phillips neighborhood, largely low income and majority people of color, as Robert identified. In recent years, we've seen a resurgence of the local business community, largely due to the influx of Latino immigrants and new businesses on Lake Street. New development on properties adjacent to the Midtown Greenway, including Uptown, the West End, and also in the Phillips area, has amounted to hundreds of millions of dollars. This progress is fragile. high-voltage lines would stop it in its tracks. Developers do not want to build underneath these lines. And there's also the issue of the fall distance and difficulty securing insurance and or financing for projects. Additional concerns of the community include electric and magnetic field impacts on trail users and adjacent residences, lost opportunity for conservation and distributed generation and the jobs that those would bring, aesthetic impacts, impacts on historical resources, and hinder or preclude the development of rail transit. We're talking passenger mass transit trains in the Midtown Greenway alongside the cycling and walking trails, which our organization does support and which is the main reason why the county purchased the corridor in the first place. So just in summary, the Midtown Greenway Coalition supports House File 1633. And thank you very much for your careful attention to this issue today.
Thank you, Mr. Springer. Representative Clark, I'm going to ask Director Glahn to come down at this time. I want to make sure that he has an opportunity to speak to this issue.
I might mention there are a lot of people here from the community, from the neighborhood, and if they don't get to speak, maybe just at some point I just ask them to be to raise their hand or something so you can see.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, I appreciate the you able to getting me in yet today. I did want to very quickly enumerate some of the concerns we have with this legislation, even the delete all amendment, which I just saw a few moments ago. I appreciate the addition of the phrase "the cities of the first class" to the bill because there aren't that many cities of the first class that to which this could apply. Although I have a high degree of confidence that somehow this would become applicable to any high-voltage transmission project in any city of the first class going forward. And the reason I say that is because just reading the language of the bill, looking at, and I happen to research, the population density of the city of Minneapolis as a whole is 6,722 from memory, below the 8,000 persons per square mile written in the bill. So now we have the Public Utilities Commission take on role of state geography and state demography as well in trying to define the zone. But just accepting the premise of the bill, which is that this applies retroactively to a single project, which is before the Public Utilities Commission today, that I guess I would, from that premise, still have concerns with the bill in that this is that... From a process standpoint, this isn't just about Xcel Energy, that my staff is the staff that would undertake the analysis on behalf of the commission on any certificate proceeding, which if it began today would introduce some substantial delay to the project, which may well impact reliability in the South Minneapolis area, of which is also my responsibility. And then finally, my concern is that if we go down this path and we establish this precedent that any transmission project of any nominal size and, you know, because I have no confidence that we'll continue to have a two-tier system in the state, that we'll have one set of laws for heavily populated metropolitan areas and another set of laws for the rest of the state, that we're just adding more and more restrictions, more and more impediments, as we heard with an earlier bill, to getting critical infrastructure built in the state. So I have a concern about the precedent we're setting by establishing this requirement for the single project. And then I have, finally, at the end of the day, if we were to go through this project and answer the questions that would be posed in it and produce the result that this project is still needed, I in the end don't think that will satisfy the community. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'll answer any questions the committee may have.
Seeing none, thank you, Director. I
have one brief question. I may have one for Xcel Energy, too, if we have time yet today, Mr. Chair. First, just an observation to the gentleman who's speaking about bike trails and so on. In the district that I'm privileged to represent, I'm thinking about a 345 and a 230 that run side by side, east and west, the 9-mile width of my district.
As we've developed some pretty nice neighborhoods along that corridor, they've been, it turns out, pretty highly desirable places to live. The greenway that we kept under the transmission line has actually turned into a pretty impressive bike and hiking trail that's connected the east and west ends of the district that I represent. It seems to be working out just fine. Just an observation, members. That's a 345 and a 230. This 115 line, though, Mr. Glawn, and this is my question. You're the reliability instructor, reliability administrator, and I'm looking at the Hiawatha project here. It looks like it's trying to balance something that's coming up 35W and up Hiawatha Avenue. Is this a project that, even if this bill moves forward, the PUC, you think, is going to have to approve anyhow for grid reliability purposes, the earlier testimony notwithstanding?
Director Glawn.
Mr. Chair, and, Representative Beard, again, not wanting to delay any further, you might want to ask Excel, but contrary to the testimony you heard earlier, there is a high-voltage line that follows Route 55 down Hiawatha, mm-hmm. to which this would interconnect. So it's not that it's unprecedented to do voltage at this level. My understanding, this would extend and provide additional backbone support for an existing voltage of that level. Chairman Hilty, I would renew, I have directly made the offer to Representative Clark to work with her to address her concerns, although she's not taken me up on that to date. I renew that offer, and I'm willing to work with her or any other member on this issue going forward.
Mr. Chair, just a quick follow-on. Concerning the reliability, I know speaking to some friends in that issue, and I know this is for you, Mr. Glawn, I suppose. It's Abbott Northwestern is in there. 2 years ago, I had a little procedure done there in my heart, and I was very grateful that the power stayed steady and strong while I was on the table anyhow. But for reliability perspectives, if this line is not built, how is this going to affect MSP in particular, which, you know, I have some interest in the aviation infrastructure? Would that airport stay strong and steady in its electrical supply if this line was not built and we just left the reliability issues up in South Minneapolis?
Director Glawn.
Mr. Chair, Representative Beer, very briefly, rather than address the MSP situation directly, I would note that I attended personally two hearings in the neighborhood where hundreds of folks attended, dozens spoke, and we heard testimony from speakers at both hearings, or I personally heard testimony from both speakers at both hearings about reliability problems in the area, brownouts, voltage problems, general reliability problems. It's my understanding that that whether it's, this is perhaps not a panacea for everyone's reliability concerns, this is in direct response to reliability concerns in that local area.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to ask Ms. Annalia Matias Vasquez to offer some comments, and then Carol.
My name is Angelina Matias Vasquez, and I live and work in this community, and I sit on the board of the Greenway. Also, I am a member of the Alina Cultural Wellness Center Backyard Initiative Commission on Health. And my job is to make my community a healthier community, but also a greener community. And I want to bring to your attention this VIO initiative report that was released back in August 31st of 2007. In that report, you will learn that the risk to the health of the people in my community will be so tragic that all the work that I and many others in my community are trying to do, and that includes Alina, it's going to be totally undermined. And I have done two studies. One I've done through the Women's Environmental Institute, for whom I also work, and I have noticed that there are a lot of children in these homes. I will tell you there was one single house where there were up to 10 kids living in that one particular household. So I'm very concerned for the children's safety in this area, not just for the general public, but I must say to you that we are very concerned about the health of these residents, and I have visited hundreds of homes in my community, and every one of them, when I ask them the question whether they wanted these high voltage power lines, they all say no. And I think that I really want you to think about these children and these families that are already suffering from so many other pollutants. We have done a study, the Women's Environmental Institute has done a study, and we have been able to map out all the different pollutants that we already have in the air and the soil in our community. And please think of all that when you're making your decision. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Chairman Hilde, for the opportunity to speak. My name is Carol Pass, and I'm the president of the East Phillips Improvement Coalition. And there's so many issues here, I don't even know. Some of them have been addressed, and so I will try to avoid some of the things I was going to say. But I've been the housing chair of this neighborhood for our part of the neighborhood for quite some time. We've worked, and it we started in 1998 with about 175 boarded buildings, 204 vacant lots. We've filled almost all of those. We've done millions of dollars worth of housing, kind of on our own backs, leveraging money and grants and et cetera. We've moved from about a 90% rental rate to about 75%. That means we have about 25% homeowners. This has radically changed the crime situation, the family livability, and et cetera. So I do have letters. I'm going to hand out I have something I want to introduce in the in your file regarding a letter and other information of the work that we've done and of developers that said that they won't develop under these lines. There's one thing with regard to this issue is that we have residents that their home is their first asset base they've ever had. The substantial drop in value of their home and their inability to resell will really perpetuate the poverty we've tried hard to avoid. When somebody buys a house and they aren't foreclosed on, we're working hard on that, and we have a good rate of success. We are really robbing them of the one thing that they've done to boost themselves out of poverty. And when you think the city isn't, I don't know what the density was that the person before me mentioned, but we have almost 20,000 people in one square mile. And so that, even though the city may be much lower, this is where the lines are. This is what we're concerned about. We're not prepared to have what we've done and worked so hard at be undermined to the degree that we know that it will be. On page 188 in the EIS, it says property values will not be severely impacted, or I think they just say they won't be impacted. This is just not true. We've researched this. We've talked to developers. I would suggest that the DELS people that prepared it would go out and do the same research that we did to find out what would really happen. The second point I wanted to make is that I went to the website of SRF Consultants and EMR, Energy Resources Management, ERM, and looked at the websites. I found I looked on the website, I tried to be thorough. I did not find an expert in public health. I didn't find concerns with public health. I didn't find concerns with economics. I did not find, with not economics of the company, but with the economics of the population that these lines run through. I didn't find this. Basically what I found, I realized they're advertisements for their company, but I found a push ahead. We can do this fast. We can avoid costly delays. We can move this through for you. I didn't find sensitivity to the population or any of that. This approach pushes us into an adversarial relationship. The other thing that I found was that I don't have time to do all the citations, but I found that the concern with public health, when public health is mentioned, that part of the DEIS has a discussion of the impact of electromagnetic fields on population. Generally, it claims that the inferences are weak when you talk about exposure of children. It points out that there isn't a causal mechanism established. And so a lot of the credibility of the studies that have been done by the National Organization for Health, and a number of other, the World Health Organizations, and et cetera, are set aside for those reasons. Yet I've found in the same documents that they quote, the World Health Organization report of 2009, that there is a consistent statistical significance over and over and over again of childhood leukemia with electromagnetic field exposure. And I have to say, I will give you a document. I don't want to read all of this because I can tell I'm going to run out of time. But I would like you to look at this because we didn't have...
Very rapidly running out of time.
Okay, we didn't find anywhere in the EIS even the quotes that lead us to these concerns. There, it just isn't there. And I would say that it is not scientifically objective, it is not good science, and they need to do this part over again because, frankly, that is our major concern. The second one is economic, but that is our major concern, is the exposure of this high density of already health-challenged children to this project's EMF. And believe me, we ask you to pass this bill, but we are very committed to not have these overhead lines go through our community, committed enough to do just about anything it takes to not have our kids exposed to this, since they've already been exposed to so much. They're all poor, minorities, and health-challenged children, many of them are, and we just ask you to let us figure this out. I want to say one last thing. I've lived in Phillips for 30 years. There is constant failure of the transformers blowing up. The wire lines have dangling insulation from them. There is the infrastructure has been left to decay to such a degree that, of course, we're having brownouts. My computer goes down because the transformer at the end of the block is so old it blew up. So I would suggest that maybe we should look at fixing this before we decide what's really needed and whether or not we should go ahead with this project. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Clark. Before we go to a vote, I'm going to ask if anyone from Excel wishes to address the committee. We didn't have anybody on the list, but I don't want to go to a vote on this bill without giving them a chance to speak.
Is this what you want?
Mr. Chair, members, Jim Alders, Director of Regulatory Administration at Xcel Energy. I've been involved in certificate of need proceedings and power line routing proceedings for 35 years at Xcel, and before that NSP. Commissioner, representatives, we very much appreciate the concerns brought by the community. The things you hear today are the same things that we hear in any proceeding where a piece of infrastructure needs to be added to the system to ensure reliability, a transmission line. Understand that there are issues associated with building facilities, and we very much have tried to work with the community, the Public Utility Commission, the Office of Energy Security, all interested parties to answer whatever the questions are. There is an existing process underway. Our fundamental concern is time. We are concerned that the bill as drafted could require a substantial additional amount of time to work our way through the process and could delay by a year or more a facility that we believe is very much needed for the community. As Representative Clark mentioned, we approached her to see if we could add some amendments to her proposal that would achieve the objectives of the bill while reducing the amount of time it took. We proposed a consolidation of the routing and need process within the existing process that's underway to minimize the amount of additional time. The amendment that their representatives, Clark's bill that's before you now, doesn't do that and could cause substantial delay, which would create additional risk to the reliability of service in South Minneapolis. And so We'd very much like the opportunity to work to see if we could achieve the objectives while minimizing that possibility of some power outages.
Any questions for Mr. Alders or for any of the witnesses? Seeing none. Representative Beard.
Sir. I have no question, just a comment before we vote, if you're ready to move to a vote, Mr. Chair.
I am, Representative Beard.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative.
I want to get crossways with the chair who's going to occupy this seat in a couple of minutes, before whom I have two bills.
Okay, just a few moments ago I heard, I believe Ms. McAbee talk about distributed power and clean energy and what they even call green energy. I prefer to call common sense. But Representative Clark, just a few miles north of you, if we're looking for additional power in downtown, you have the Crown Hydro Project, 3 to 4 megawatts of clean green power that could move right into there with no additional infrastructure. I certainly hope I can count on your support to help move the Minneapolis Park Board out of the way and get that project moving along. Thank you.
Representative Ackbar.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I find it a little bit, you know, ironic that now we're hearing this bill right after we hear Representative Kelly's bill talking about local control, and here we are carving out a specific area to not allow something to move forward, and we had a bill earlier that was going to allow local government and local folks to have a say, and now here we are with some local folks that want to have a say, and they're bringing forward specific legislation. I think that what we've got here today now on this particular bill sets a dangerous precedent for establishing for other communities to come in and say, no, I want to put a stop to our project too from happening and coming through our community. So, Mr. Chairman, I would ask for a roll call vote to find out exactly, are we going to be hypocritical on this and vote one way, 5 minutes later, vote another way? I mean, I just don't understand this, Mr. Chairman. I'd like a roll call vote. As much as I hate to do that, and I want to move on to the next committee, too, I'm going to be there for the next several hours, Mr. Chairman.
Roll call has been called for. Representative Purcell, briefly.
Try and be brief. Just a clarification for me only, perhaps, but when we started out, we talked about there was discussion about a mile and a half or a mile and a quarter of line, and there's a 10-mile cutoff as far as a certificate of need if I have everything straight. Right. And I'm looking at this handout, and it says it's 12.2 miles. How did we get? That's more than 10. I've got that in my head now.
Right.
So how did we get down to that we don't need a certificate of need on this?
Mr. Chairman, what a good question. Thank you. This document is from a public document, 2007 and 2009, a legislative report required called the Transmission Project Report that Excel produced. So this is their own, my understanding is this is their own document. This was under discussion. And we came across this just recently that it indicates that, indeed, they have been talking about a 12.2-mile transmission line project, but for purposes of the neighborhood, all we've been told is that it's a mile and a half, and we have to take care of it for that. And so we really do need this time. We do need time to try to understand what's really going on and what's at stake here. And I might point out that maybe that answers your question, first of all.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Purcell.
Well, it appears that it is a project that's 12.2 miles in length. And I'm seeing some contradictory head shaking.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Alders.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Representative, what's been referred to is a long-range planning study. We identified a number of alternatives in that planning study. In the long run, if a lot of different things happen and growth continues in the entire South metro area, not just South Minneapolis, then at some point in the future, decades or more away, there may be the need for additional transmission lines. Our proposal before the Public Utility Commission that this particular amendment was written for is for a line that's about 1.4 miles long. And before we could do anything, we would have to go back to the commission.
Representative Hackbarth, before we go to the vote, I would mention that There has been mention to amendments brought forward by Excel today, actually. This is an issue that this bill was introduced in the last session. This has been an issue. This issue has been before us for more than a year. And even so, I have made a commitment to try to work with Excel and Representative Clark to see if we can resolve the issue to everyone's satisfaction. It's not my fault that the amendment or the suggested solution to this only came to my attention a few hours ago. But even so, I would like publicly to say that I'm committed to working with these parties to try to make sure that everyone's happy. With that, the clerk will take the roll. Hilton. Chair votes aye.
Falk.
Aye.
Westrom. Anderson.
No.
Adkins. Beard.
No.
Bly.
Aye.
Reinert.
Aye.
Gunther. Hackbarth.
No.
Hoppe.
No.
Bartman.
Aye.
Johnson.
Aye.
Kalen.
Pass.
Knuth.
Aye.
Kulik Jackson.
Aye.
Magnus.
Aye.
Nornis.
No.
Obermuller.
Aye.
Purcell.
Aye.
Saylor.
Aye.
Seifert.
No.
Welty.
No. There being 12 ayes and 7 nays, the bill is passed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members.
Pardon me. Yes, meeting is adjourned. Thank you, Representative Barrett.
Sure, you're welcome.